Get the best quality paints from Dutch Boy for all your projects at Menards. MaxBond Plus exterior paint and primer in one is designed to stand strong against extreme weather. It provides max adhesion, hide, and performance, and repels rain in just 90 minutes after application. And with Dutch Boy's high-performing paints that last, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards today and get your paint project started. Save big money
at Menards. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a weekend version of the podcast of the Lotus Eaters. I'm not sure what day you'll get this on, so I won't give you a date. Probably on the Sunday, though. The 13th, I think it'll be. But I'm talking to Hugo about Joe Biden's cabinet picks. Now, he's not quite the president-elect yet. That's still been denied, but he's being reported as if he is the president-elect, so we'll just say that for now, just for simplicity's sake. Right, Hugo, so how's it looking? Is the swamp back or is the swamp back?
Oh, it is back. as an overview, the people that Biden has picked are from the Obama era. Everyone probably knows that by now.
It's not a surprise.
It's not a surprise. Just as he is a continuation of Obama and of his presidency, so is his cabinet picks. Just like, the same people, and not just like the same kind of people, but literally the same people.
Actually, those people. Yeah.
And that's not surprising either, because most of these people have long careers in politics. Maybe they left politics in 2016 or 17 when they got thrown out, and now they're coming
left
back.
Politics, meaning got kicked out by Trump being Obama appointees.
I took this from I think CNN or something else, but it should be fairly up to date. Maybe there's been some others, but we're going to be talking about some of these. Most notably, the Secretary of State, the prospective Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, and then Janet Yellen, obviously. And there's some others that are also important, but for some of those, you can actually. It's actually fairly difficult to find information like those down positions below the big line. Yeah. Like that's the cabinet rank status positions, but it's not actually secretaries of something. And so if you go down there, it's actually quite difficult to find stuff on those people. Hmm. And I actually started preparing this segment by figuring out how they're connected to the Great Reset, because that's been like running theme throughout the weekend podcast. But
next weekend we'll have more on the Great Reset.
So I wanted to tie it to the Great Reset because I suspected that these people will have something to say on it, but they actually don't. Most of them are just like not really relevant to it. And so I'm starting to think that the Great Reset is just like a very European project at its heart, and it's just very it is German.
I mean, it seems to be, doesn't it?
There are definitely people in the US who take part in it and who running.
I imagine someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would probably support the Great Reset.
Sure, but I guess most of these people would too, but what I was looking for is definitive connections, like friendships or like
open endorsements,
or speeches like at the World Economic Forum or things like that. That hasn't happened, to the best of my knowledge. But I think I can safely say that most of these people would be on board with the Great Reset. So it's not like they wouldn't. Yeah, supported it.
But like you say, it seems that the Great Reset is more Eurocentric.
Yeah. And there are obviously Americans who are part of it, officially part of it.
And maybe sympathetic, just not on their radar. Really.
Exactly. But it's just the people who like swim in international waters. Yeah. It's not primarily those who are involved personally in American politics, right? Because they have other things to do. Just because the US is such a huge kind of
bastion in the political landscape.
Exactly. Yeah, so such a huge player.
The Great Reset does feel like a way for Europe to be relevant, to be honest.
I can see that.
Nothing tangible, but you know what I mean? It's like Europe's relevance is fading.
Yeah, I can
see
that.
And they know it, you know? And so this could be a way of... But anyway.
And what we were talking about last week, that there is this tug of war. It could be a tug of war between the UN and the US. European countries and European leaders mostly would probably join the side of the UN or try to be like it that, is. Right? And so that could be an aspect of it, an angle that you could view it from. So I agree with you in that. Right, and so let's get on with it then. So Kamala Harris, everyone knows about her, so we're not going to talk about her. That's
she's quite high profile.
Yeah, yeah. And so the first one is the Secretary of State, and so it's the nominee is Antony Blinken. He's got some official credentials. He's an established chief person, right? He studied social studies at Harvard and then law at Columbia. Pretty much expected. Most of these have studied at Ivy League schools. That's standard for the US, obviously.
That's no surprise at all.
And so he, under Obama, he was the national security advisor to the vice president, so to Biden. And then he went on to be the deputy national secretary advisor and then the deputy secretary of state. So he's actually been in this position before, just as a deputy, not as the main guy. Right. And so he'll undoubtedly do good job in that position, just because he knows how those things operate.
He knows how it works. And like you say, a good job will be done.
It doesn't mean what comes out of it is good.
Well, good is a relative term.
It might get worse.
There's no such thing as objective good. Christians, don't come at me. Yep. In politics, there are no objective goods. There are only subjective goods. And so, and good, essentially, I think, just means in your interests. So in someone's interest, Antony Blinken will do a very excellent job.
Yeah, but those interests might be a bit dubious, because the first thing I have here is his war record, which is atrocious.
Oh, just God. Like,
why these people? Like, so obviously he supported the Iraq war. I haven't been able to find anything that he said about it since, but I don't know. Many people who had voted for the Iraq war have come out in some sense against it later, but with most of them it doesn't really seem sincere. They continue to vote for new wars or something like that, or it just seems like a PR stunt.
Yeah.
And so he supported the Iraq war, he supported the Libya war, he was basically the architect of the Syrian war, because he was the deputy secretary of state, and then he supported the war in Yemen in 2015 as well.
He sounds like a neocon.
I mean, the difference between neoconservatism and neoliberalism is very thin, and that's been kind of established very well especially in the last few years.
I agree.
But I'm just reading off of this. So Blinken assisted then Senator Joe Biden, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in formulating Biden's support for the U.S. invasion of Iraq, with Blinken characterizing the vote to invade Iraq as, quote, a vote for tough diplomacy.
Well, I mean, it is. Like, war is definitely tough diplomacy. Clausewitz agrees, Blinken.
It's definitely correct.
It absolutely is. You know?
No lies detected. with the Syria war, that's where he was really prominent. He has been described as one of the government's key players in drafting Syria policy, because he was up there.
Yeah.
He supported the supply to weapons to Syrian rebels, and so this whole thing that happened in Syria.
Oh my God! Yeah. So for anyone who doesn't know, basically the U.S. government chose a couple of factions in the Syrian civil war that they claimed they thought were, quote, moderates, and it turned out long after the fact that, in fact, unsurprisingly, the borders between the various Islamist groups that were occupying Syria at the time were incredibly porous, and the people in these groups moved in and out of them, and ISIS and other, you know, various other, I can't remember the various names they went under, and the US weapons ended up getting passed all around all of the jihadi groups, didn't they?
Yeah, and there weren't numerous groups, but they were kind of divided into three main camps: the Syrian government, the Islamic State, and the Syrian rebels, right?
Yeah.
And the rebels are the collection of groups which the US ended up supporting. They ended up supporting them after, like, withdrawing their tacit support for Assad, and after withdrawing their support from the Islamic State support, right? Because Islamic State was born out of the funding of a splinter group from Al-Qaeda, which been funded by the US. So
the whole thing was just, you can just chalk it up into the category of bad decision.
Yep.
You really can.
Yeah. Yep. That's been a running theme, like war policy of the US is atrocious.
Yeah, the Obama foreign policy was just rubbish.
It didn't even start with Obama. It's been like a long running theme. Obama Obama only made it much worse because he started all these wars.
You're right. Sorry, carry on.
No.
It's nice to see the people who are actually responsible for such bad decisions. Yeah. But it's not nice to see Joe Biden saying, hey, we're bringing these back, you know.
It's going to be continuities.
Yeah.
And so after Trump was elected, he got his term ended. And he, in 2017, after leaving politics, he co-founded the political strategy advising firm called West Exec Advisors. And so that's a consulting firm, but there's like differences in consulting firms. But what it means here is a firm which tells you about how to do policy, how to do strategic stuff within mm-hmm. political circles, so it ends up in your favor. And so the firm clientele includes the defense industry, private equity firms, and hedge funds. So,
okay, all of the worst people that you don't want aligned have all become aligned in this person. Right, okay. That's good. I mean, as Di Dongsheng says, we can fix Wall Street. You know, you can fix all of these things.
And it gets worse.
Yeah, it does. We're going to have to start selling those mugs.
The co-founder of he co-founded it with, I think, two other people, and the other co-founder said that West Execs, that's the company, West Execs' role is facilitating relationships between Silicon Valley firms and the Department of Defense and law enforcement.
Why is that desirable?
Well, need some type of cooperation, but this is not it.
Okay.
Right. And so, actually, he hasn't been he has been a Trump opposer, obviously, a Trump critic, but he hasn't been. I don't think he has TDS or anything like that. Blinken praised the Trump administration brokered normalization agreements between Israel, Bahrain, and the UAE. So he's saying, okay, this good job done, I guess.
Well, the sort of neocon neoliberal consensus demands it, doesn't it? Because a lot of it was focused around Israel.
Yes, but at the same time, a lot of those people don't care about that if Trump does it, right? So the Trump peace deals across the Middle East haven't received much attention in the media just because.
Well, yeah, but I'm not talking about the media. I'm talking about literally these particular actors. They were very, you know, it comes from the sort of George Bush framing of Israel, our greatest ally in the Middle East, and all this sort of thing. So Israel's a very key component of America's strategic policy in the Middle East. And so Trump, presumably, I mean, the Israelis seem to love Trump because of what he's managed to achieve. And so Trump having a continuation of that in a different direction, away from war towards peace, you know, at least that you can see that he's got some measure of consistency there. Antony Blinken has got some measure of consistency there. So it makes him a sort of predictable actor in a way.
Yeah, and I think it's nice that he doesn't have TDS at least.
Honestly, I would be surprised if any of these people actually did. I think that when you get, I've been soured in many ways over the years, and I think there is an awful lot of cynicism at the top of these sort of positions. And like I said, I like, because the Trump derangement syndrome people are people who seem to have been idealistic, and you know, it's principally what Trump is and how he operates and what he represents that they're principally in opposition to. It's not practical people like these.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's much more of an academic,
an
phenomenon.
Activist phenomenon.
So yeah, so let's move on to like his other foreign policy. So Blinken said that the Trump administration helped China. Actually helped China by, quote, weakening American alliances, leaving a vacuum in the world for China to fill, abandoning our values and giving China a green light to trample on human rights and democracy from Xinjiang to Hong Kong.
What?
So
when did Obama oppose this?
Trump's
the only guy who's been speaking about China.
Yeah, but his argument is different. Is that the only way that you can face China as as a power from the West is not that you're going to be militant towards it, but that you will ally all of the Western states.
Yeah, create a web around China. Exactly. I understand what he's trying to say there, but I just don't agree. I don't think the Chinese government care.
And it's. I think it's not just that.
Bribe people as well.
Good point. I think what he would say is that when all of these all of these states have an alliance, when they are kind of all on one side, they can, when necessary, exert enough pressure for China to kind of not be able to do something wrong. But the other question then that follows is, are they going to do it? Are they going to be willing to do it? Is it actually something that he wants to do, that he wants to confront China on these issues?
Right? Because I trust the Joe Biden administration to confront China?
Some of those people have been talking about human rights issues in China, but I don't really tend to believe that they are actually interested in it.
Yeah.
Beyond press stuff and PR stunts. So
yeah, absolutely.
It's not really trustworthy when it's coming from them. You know, so, right, and now I've got an interesting detail on the Kurds in Syria and what Blinken has said about it. So in 2015, Blinken said that judging between Turkey and the Syrian Kurdish YPG was, quote, not even a matter of this discussion, since Turkey is, quote, an important ally. Fair enough.
NATO member.
Fair enough. Then in 2017, Blinken published an op-ed in the New York Times arguing for arming Syrian Kurds to defeat ISIS, while simultaneously urging the US to double down on support for Turkey fight against the PKK.
Right, okay. For anyone who doesn't know, the PKK are communists.
But they also fought against ISIS.
Yeah, that's right.
But he said, arm them, but arm the Turks as well. They're basically at war with each other, so that makes sense, sure. And then he criticized President Trump's decision to withdraw US troops from northern Syria, obviously.
Of course he did.
So that's in line with his previous support for the war. So Biden and Blinken have indicated that their plan to recommit the United States to the multilateral treaties from which Trump has withdrawn, so that's kind of standard, and that's also a running theme through these people. Mm-hmm. They see the US as a very isolationist, quote unquote, now, as very bilateralist instead of multilateralist. And so they want to reverse that kind of tendency. And so they want to rejoin the Paris Accord, for example, the Climate Accord. Yeah. And then they want to promote and kind of make larger scope available for agencies like the UN and others, like international institutions,
global organizations,
and that's where I think it's relevant to say that's where I'm taking the claim from, that they would probably support the Great Reset if they were asked about it, or if they were supposed to say something on whether
these people would doubtless speak at Davos.
I think they would welcome it, and so. There is a tweet that should be up on the screen now, or in a second, or we can put it there later. And so, nominee to lead State Department Tony Blinken recently explained that Biden's pledge to, quote, end the forever wars means the U.S. will reduce large-scale deployments while expanding secret wars waged by special forces and proxies. So that's someone who is
good
not...
Good news!
That's not someone who's in favor of Blinken, obviously. But it's also funny because he quotes Biden as saying, we'll end the forever wars, but... the people who Biden actually wants to appoint are people who support the forever wars and who lobbied for them in the first place. So this is a bit weird.
We're going to end telling you about the forever wars, and our drones will have Black Lives Matter written on them as they bomb Arabs.
This is a view of Blinken's opponents and Biden's opponents.
But I think
it's not inaccurate in any way. No.
Yeah.
And that's what Obama has done as well. Like his the way that he was able to... kind of ramp up and start all the wars, even without Congress's approval in many cases, was that he did that in secret. Like, not completely in secret, but he did that. He ramped up drone warfare that had started under Bush. He expanded that into like a huge thing, and because of that, it didn't get that much media attention, because if no one's manning it, if it just the side of the bad guys like getting killed and nothing is actually happening to your army, no one's moving around, why should you care?
Especially declare it as a war?
Especially if you're the corporate press.
Yes.
Right. So the New York Times describes Blinken as a defender of global alliances, which is in line with what we've already said. So that's a fair description, I think, of what he is in kind of international relations.
Yeah.
And then
we can see the kind of guy he is.
And then the question is whether that's good or bad, right?
That's down to your opinion.
Right. So let's move on to Janet Yellen. She's the Treasury Secretary appointee, and she's got great cred as well. She's one of the most accomplished women in economics living around today, and so she studied at Brown University and then at Yale in economics, obviously. And she was the Fed chair from 2014 until 2018. She started under Obama, continued under Trump. He hasn't kicked her out. He didn't kick her out at the beginning of his term, but he continued with her for like 2 more years, I think. Yep. And so she hasn't been that outspoken against him. Mm-hmm. Only in the past few months, I think, in line with her appointment to the Secretary of Treasury. Yeah.
It's important to note as well that Biden probably had spoken to all of these people long before the election, mm-hmm, as mm-hmm. well. You know, it's unlikely that this was suddenly dropped on her lap the other day.
No,
and for the first time.
Most of these people Biden actually knew from his tenure as vice president. That's understandable.
He's going to have his phones, emails. Yeah, he's going to go to country clubs with them.
Yep. And you know, most of those people he has worked with or worked with at some point in his life, or maybe for many years in some cases. Mm. And so he tries to have his kind of close circle around him and not veer off too far.
Yeah.
Maybe he's afraid of a coup by Kamala Harris or something like that.
Ooh.
I don't know, but I wouldn't put it past her. So
I wouldn't either. I mean,
that would be spicy.
Kamala's fake smile as she puts a bullet in the back of Joe Biden's head.
Yep.
Yeah. Sorry, nice pick.
So, Yellen is not like a good person for the job, I would say.
Okay.
Even though she's got great credentials, yeah, because her views on economics and on economic policy is really weird. It's not weird. That's not fair to say, because it's fairly common, but it's
Keynesian.
Sadly predictable. She's a Keynesian. She's
how did I know?
She's been described as a Keynesian to her fingertips.
How did I know?
So she believes in the modern version of the Phillips curve. The Phillips curve is the idea that there is a trade-off between unemployment and inflation, and if you lower one by fiat, by some kind of intervention, the other one goes higher and reverse, right? And so the classical or the task that central banks are supposed to have is to balance between the two, and if one is too high, they're supposed to make it lower, and they're supposed to make it so that the economy works well, right? So that's the idea. The problem with it is that it's based on a weird understanding of the economy as a whole. So if your underlying view of the economy is not really accurate, you're not going to produce good policies if you act on it. And so, Yellen got famous in 2017 by saying that another financial crisis is not likely in our lifetime.
Predictions that age well.
Well, coronavirus is not her fault or anything, so
but it is a financial crisis.
Sure, but yeah.
Well, don't make predictions like that, Jesus. Like your mug says, it gets worse. That should just be the default perspective. And if it gets better, well, that was a bonus, wasn't it?
Yep. I have to defend her for a little bit here, because if you're at that position of a Fed chair, you're supposed to tell everyone that everything is going well and that there are no problems, because the big actors in the financial markets will react to what you say very quickly and very strongly, because if you think something is wrong and something is going wrong, you're likely to change your policies according to that, and that will affect them as well. So they need to be able to kind of channel what the Fed is thinking and what the Fed chair is thinking. And so she must be really like clear about, no, not everything's okay, we're not going to change anything, or if we are, we're going to tell you up front. And so this they're really stiff about it.
And it's not necessarily her fault that that's the case.
No, either. No.
People think that like financial markets are dominated by like world events. It's like, no, often they're dominated by just opinion and perception.
Yeah, yeah.
It's and fear, you know, and because the essentially they're just trying to maintain the status quo.
And that's a similar thing that the press is pretending not to understand with Trump, for example, with coronavirus. Like his job is to make people think that everything is safe and fine, and he said so himself.
Yeah.
When they asked him, he was like, I'm not going to cause a panic. Like, that's not my job. That's literally the opposite of my job. And so even if something is not fine, I'm going to work on it But out here, I'm going to say that everything's fine. And that's perfectly reasonable and that's understandable.
That's what you would want a leader to do. You don't want a leader spreading panic. That's the worst thing.
And so when she says another financial crisis is not likely in our lifetime, you remember.
Yeah, you can see what she's coming from.
Yeah, but you also remember Keynes, who said in 1927 that we will not have any more crashes in our time.
Never make a prediction as an economist.
Or
a politician, or anyone who deals with anything. Just don't make predictions.
All I'm saying is she's being true to her master. So,
ooh.
Her teacher.
No, her master's a good way of framing it. Go on.
So, but after she left, she
Keynesian to her fingertips, apparently.
She said that in 2017, but in 2018, after she left, she warned of the possibility of a financial crisis by citing, quote, gigantic holes in the system after her departure from the Federal Reserve. And so that actually ties back to what I was saying a bit ago, that she needs to portray everything as fine when she's actually in the position, but when she's out, she can say tell the truth, because not people's action don't rely on it as much, and so she can actually say that the system is very flimsy and that a lot of things are wrong in it, which I agree with. So good on her. Apparently, she can be honest. No, I don't mean to trash talk her. She looks like an amiable person, personally.
Yeah,
not in politics though.
Just her economic views are, I think, debunked at this point, frankly.
Yeah, and even the Wall Street Journal said that her Keynesian understanding of macroeconomics is literally half a century out of date.
I didn't mean to jump the gun there, but yeah, no, I'm very sour.
It's not
on
me
Keynesian,
saying it.
Yeah.
Right, and so the world can. The only connection to anything that's tied to Great Reset that I found with. In relation to her is the World Economic Forum in 2013. Someone who only wrote this one article said that wrote a piece titled "How Janet Yellen Can Steer the U.S. Economy to Recovery." Right. That was 2013. Yeah. It was nothing.
Yeah,
and it wasn't even an official person with a position.
She didn't sign it or write it.
Yeah,
it was just about her.
Yeah.
There's nothing there.
And so it's still on their website. So that line. Presumably some ways, but it's not a big deal.
Well, I mean, I'm not surprised. If you're in favor of the Great Reset, it just seems like Keynesianism on steroids.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, you know, I'm not surprised they're looking at the arch-Keynesian to her fingertips and saying, well, she could be our girl. I don't doubt.
No, she's not the arch-Keynesian. The previous Fed chairs are still alive.
Oh, are they? Right, okay.
Yeah, Bernanke and Greenspan is still alive as well, I think.
Yeah.
Well, but
God, I haven't heard Bernanke's name in ages.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, go on.
He's actually mentioned in the article is that Bernanke something I can't remember, but in that article what they say is something like Bernanke was a shepherd that led the U.S. through the crisis, something like that.
Oh, what a noble man!
No mention of how him and Greenspan previously like inflated the bubble. Right?
Yeah,
and
never mind.
It didn't happen. No, and so one last interesting thing about Yellen is her husband actually, because he seems like a way more questionable person than her, because he wrote he's left wing, That's a mild description of him. And he he's co-written a book called Fishing for Fools. Didn't know what that's referring to, but that's a book that he published in 2015 together with George Akerlof and Robert Schiller. And the authors of this book wrote without, I'm quoting, without even a hint of irony, that people, quote, do not do what is really good for them. They do not choose what they really want.
Well, I mean, he's right. They don't do what's really good for them. Otherwise, they wouldn't smoke, drink, and eat fatty food and sugar.
Yeah, but what is meant by that is that you need to steer people and nudge people to do certain things, and
of course
you need to have a command economy,
of course,
so that you can actually get people what they want.
Of course.
And so that's very much in line with some of the ideas that the Great Reset involves. That's why I wanted to highlight that.
Yeah.
And it's not just her husband, it's her as well, because he recently told the New York Times that he and Yellen have, quote, always been in all but perfect agreement about macroeconomics. So,
okay.
So you need to know. And just one last thing is that recent comments from Yellen suggest that she will push for a new stimulus when in office. So the $1.5 trillion stimulus that was passed earlier this year, she's going to try to do it again just to...
Oh, wow.
To attempt to bridge the coronavirus crisis in that way.
Keynesian promotes new bubble.
What else is new?
Yeah, what a shock. Let's inflate the economy artificially. Yeah, okay, why not? I knew that you were going to say that. Sorry.
It's like the hammer and the nail.
Yeah, exactly. It really is. And as the New York Times said, discredited for 50 years. And yet, here we are.
They didn't say about this.
Keynesianism generally.
Fair enough, but the Phillips curve is one of the like major things that was kind of overhauled back then.
Yeah.
And they have modernized, but it's still... It's
just the wrong way of looking
exactly.
at productivity, in my opinion.
Yep. Right, and so
Hayek was right. The Austrians were right. God, I'm going to get lots of angry comments. And I'm not even very well read on the differences. But
we can read something for the book.
Yeah, we should. I mean, I've got a cursory understanding, I think.
Right.
But yeah, we should. We should choose something. Recommend us something in the comments.
And so we can move on to Lloyd Austin, who's the future, maybe, Secretary of Defense.
Yep.
And he used to be a U.S. Army general. Mm-hmm. He was famous for being a very prominent black person in the army, which is good, nice achievement.
Yeah.
He personally fought in the Iraq War and in the war in Afghanistan, so he's got personal experience there.
Mm-hmm.
In 2016, he retired from armed services and subsequently served on the boards of Raytheon Technologies, Nuco, and Tenet Healthcare. Raytheon, just to note, is a large U.S. military contractor.
Yeah, I know who Raytheon are.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I really, we shouldn't be very surprised. What we're talking about are the constituent parts of the swamp. That all of those sort of Lee Camp style political commentators and comedians have been complaining about for decades now. Well, I hope your endorsement of Joe Biden was worth it, lads. You got what you wanted, not Trump.
Yeah, and so it's like even if he wasn't part of on the board of a defense contractor, even if it was just an army person, you don't really want people like that as secretaries of defense. It's like if you wanted to stop eating junk food and you appointed as your dietitian someone from McDonald's, right? It's like it's in their interest, financial and otherwise, to promote one side of that problem, you know, of that issue.
Yeah.
And so that's not it. It's not, I'm not hopeful.
I mean, this is a return to the 2000s to 2010 sort of 12. Like neoliberal neocon status quo, isn't it?
Yep.
This is like the pre-Trump era from the year 2000 onwards.
Yep. There's really not much to say about him. He's got some degrees, so
sure,
good
for
him.
I'm not doubting all of these people are credentialed.
And but one interesting thing, like a snippet of what he's like, is that he apparently has a habit of referring to himself in the third person.
Oh my God, that's. Right, that's weird.
And I just have that from Wikipedia, but apparently it's because he's so humble or something like that.
That's not what that does.
Or maybe he's shy. Like that's the impression that I got.
But. Right. Okay. Well, it's not normally humble for a person to refer to themselves in the third person. Nope. Normally, it's the opposite, and it demonstrates supreme arrogance that like a Persian emperor would have. But yeah.
Yep. Yep. So.
You know, like the Persian emperor would say, Darius the First commands you to do something. You know, that's how it comes across. Now, I'm not saying, I've never met the guy, I'm not saying that he's like that or anything. It's just, it's a really weird thing to do.
It's a weird thing. And even if you're shy, like, there's other ways you can deal with that problem than just, what is this?
Okay.
So let's move on then to the chief of staff. It's Ron Klein. That's the kind of a person who's been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. He's a lawyer. He studied Harvard. He was the chief of staff to the vice president, to Al Gore as vice president, and then to Biden as vice president as well. And so he used to be part of Al Gore's office. Al Gore is famous for being the environmental candidate, mm-hmm. but the environmental guy.
Famous for the guy who said that by 2008 there would be no polar ice caps.
Yes.
Just saying that wasn't correct. There are, at the time of recording, still polar ice caps.
And so it
was an inconvenient truth, unfortunately.
And so in line with that history, he's married to Monica Medina. She's a lawyer and environmental activist that served as principal deputy undersecretary of commerce for oceans and atmosphere. So that's kind of those kind of circles. Yep. So no surprise there. He's famous for being the Ebola Tsar.
Oh, okay.
So that's that guy.
But I mean, they did prevent the Ebola pandemic and outbreak, did they not?
Well,
I didn't look into this.
That's what I actually want to play.
Oh, okay.
Video. If you can get it up, John.
I just had a couple things. I mean, I was in the White House in 2009, 2010. I was working for Vice President Biden. I wasn't involved directly in the H1N1 response, but I lived through it as a White House staffer. And what I will say about it is, a bunch of really talented, really great people working on it, and we did every possible thing wrong. And it's, you know, 60 million Americans got H1N1 in that period of time, and it's just purely a fortuity that this isn't one of the great mass casualty events in American history. Had nothing to do with us doing anything right. Just had to do with luck. And so if anyone thinks that this can't happen again, they don't have to go back to 1918, they just have to go back to 2009, 2010. Imagine a virus with a different lethality. And you can just do the math on that. Now,
so he's someone who's obviously going to be in favor of coronavirus lockdowns.
Presumably. But the important thing about this is that when he said that they did prevent a huge outbreak and huge calamity, he himself is saying that they did everything wrong and just by luck, nothing happened.
Well, that was for swine flu. H1N1, that wasn't for the Ebola thing, right?
Right, yeah. You're right about that. Yep.
But either way...
Yep.
I mean, admitting that actually we didn't do anything useful, not exactly filling me with confidence.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I mean, I approve of his honesty.
Yeah, it's nice. I don't actually know when this is from, and so it could be political in some way, but I don't know. He seems to be honest about it.
Yeah.
Right, and when you're asking about what he thinks about lockdowns, he supports, quote, national strategy, quote, coordinated federal strategy. He said that in an August interview. And so I don't know if he would be in favor of lockdowns because they asked him about it and he was like, he didn't answer that. He just said, we need to do these things in a coordinated way. We need to have federal policy. We can't have these shattered states doing each doing a different thing. And so that's his main point. Right. His main point is federal action and not lockdown. But he might be in support of lockdowns in the future as well. So it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest.
No, I wouldn't be surprised either.
Right. And so the next are actually the people... the people that are cabinet level, but not secretaries. And with those, we would start with Neera Tanden. And she's she's supposed to be the director of the Office of Management and Budget. She's a Yale law person. And she's really like she's close to the Clintons, and she's actually one of the closest people that Clintons have had. She's like a confidant, and she's being portrayed like that. And she used to be Hillary Clinton's aide, and she's been regarded as a Clinton loyalist and a personal friend of Hillary Clinton. In some interviews, she said that when my daughter was born, Hillary was the first person that called me. I don't know if. What it says about my family, but it definitely, I know what it says about Hillary Clinton. That's just
How stunning and brave.
Yep.
I mean, the stench of the Clintons is going to be in U.S. politics for decades after they've died. You know, after you know, decades and decades. But sorry, go on.
No, it's just funny that she's being such a simp for him. It's so painful. It's so painful to watch these things. You can watch it on YouTube. Like it's just her name and just like speeches. She's also got a voice that she don't really want to listen to. It's not her fault. So in September 2013, when President Obama was considering bombing Syria, Tandon tweeted that she supported U.S. intervention, quote, "On Syria, while I don't want to be the world's policeman, an unpoliced world is dangerous. The U.S. may be the only adult in the room left."
Well, I mean, she is right that an unpoliced world is dangerous, and the U.S. does find itself in the position of having occupying a lot of space that will be turned into a vacuum if it withdraws. And that's not wrong. It's not a wrong analysis. And it does put the U.S. in a difficult position, frankly. And so I'm personally not non-interventionist, but I would have a very strict and high bar for intervention were I to ever advocate intervention somewhere. I don't think these people have nearly as strict a standard as myself.
Well, while she said that, she also later said that she opposed deploying U.S. soldiers to Syria. So she supported bombing them and droning them, but soldiers, nah, that's too much. So she's being a moderate.
There's a pride flag on the bombs. What are you complaining about?
Yeah, I actually tried to find the pride flag bomb memes and the rainbow bombs. I couldn't find it. So. Yeah, and so there is Avril Haines. She's supposed to be the director of national intelligence. She's a CIA person. She had a CIA crook, let's say. Yep.
She didn't get the chair of CIA director, though, did
she? Yeah, yeah.
Oof.
She used to be the CIA director, though, I think.
Oh, did she used to
be?
I think so.
I'm not sure about it, though, not 100%. Well, next is Jake Sullivan. He's supposed to be the national security advisor. Mm-hmm. He's a Clinton man. Simple. Nothing special.
The swamp.
Then the special presidential envoy for climate is supposed to be John Kerry.
Oh, of course it's
and
John Kerry.
That's a big name, right?
Well, he's a Skull and Bones man.
Yeah.
He was in Skull and Bones with George Bush. Yeah, he is a big name.
So he's a professional fraud. Look him up.
Yeah, he is, there are certain names, and Kerry is one of them that you wouldn't want in government again.
So he fought in the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. and then he became an anti-Vietnam War activist in the final years of the war. And then he supported all the wars afterwards.
Well, as long as he didn't have to fight in them, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know if all the wars, that double check me on that, but at least some of them he did. I checked that much. And so I don't really think that's a trustworthy person.
Yeah, we don't
with
need
good intentions.
No, definitely not John Kerry.
Right. And then there is the UN ambassador, Linda Thomas Greenfield, who taught political science at Bucknell. She's had a career in diplomacy, 35 years in the U.S. Foreign Service, and she said when she was announced as the pick, and when all of these people have been announced as picks, she said, "America is back. Multilateralism is back. Diplomacy is back. Mr. President-elect, I've often heard you say how all politics is personal and how you build relationships of trust and bridge disagreements and find common ground."
Well, I mean, she's not wrong. So, Joe Biden, you need a lot of trust to commit the kind of malfeasance that Joe Biden has been doing under the table. To shift around tens of millions of dollars from China, Russia, and the Ukraine, it requires a huge amount of trust. She's completely right. completely right. I mean, that, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Then all it takes is a crackhead to spoil it.
Yeah, a crackhead Kuma screws it all up.
So what's interesting about this quote and her approach that she lays out is that it differs from how Trump sees diplomacy, in that Trump sees it as, okay, we're going to negotiate, we're going to kind of gather what we have, what leverage we have, and they're going to undoubtedly do the same. Yeah. And then we're going to just like go at it, and we're probably going to gain something. And it will be a back and forth.
He'll demand 100%, exactly. Get 30%, they'll demand, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. We know how Trump negotiates. Yeah, he wrote a book about it, or Ghost wrote a book about it.
This is like a different approach, saying, okay, we want to be friends, and if we're friends, we can do things together, and it's going to be better. We're going to, if we cooperate, we can build things that we wouldn't be able to if we just have at it.
Yeah. But the problem I have with this kind of, I guess we'll just call it the cooperative mentality, is that it takes a view above the things that are currently interacting. Like, Trump is acting from within the American paradigm. We are America. We are recognize you as a separate sovereign state that we are now going to deal with. And then the various power differences and strategic advantages that we have will all come into play. We'll come to an arrangement, come to negotiation, and it will be effectively accepting you as an equal, but of inferior status, of inferior power, you know, peer. But this acts as if you are the person playing both sides of the chessboard. You know, as if you're the one who gets to dictate. And so you're acting kind of from the position of the chessboard itself rather than from an actor on it. And that's the perspective I think is quite dangerous, actually.
Yeah, I think you're right in that. But I think that the primary danger of this approach is that it's very vulnerable to abuse. Like anyone who comes in there and just kind of leads you into thinking that they're having good intentions and they're cooperating with you, they can do anything behind your back, and they can
promote it in front of your face.
Yeah, they can promote their own goals, but just spin it so that you think that they're being cooperative. And it doesn't eliminate all these conflicts. It just pushes them one step further into like back rooms and into like scheming instead of it happening in the open as what happens with the Trump strategy, right?
And the
conflicts remain the same. They just happen elsewhere.
Yeah, and Trump is at least upfront and honest about them, whereas these things, like you say, they're done through the back rooms and usually through money. But this is the problem, the sort of like the sort of ultimate version of universalization that you end up needing if you are to adopt the position of the chessboard, because now you have to take in the interests and the beliefs and values of both sides, and this leads to absurdities like the Saudi Arabia chairing the UN Women's Rights Council and things like this. It's like, no, that in a sensible, sane world where we were committed to our values, that wouldn't happen, but because we're not, and we've got to accommodate Saudi Arabia as much as we accommodate other things, you get these kind of bizarre absurdities.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the view then becomes you have to accommodate, and by accommodating them, you kind of validate what they are doing, instead of saying, no, we don't agree with them, but we need to make some concessions to get what we want. And thereby, you validate it as well, but you don't... But it doesn't.
You're not endorsing their beliefs.
Exactly.
That's the difference.
You're not forced to endorse it, but you're saying, okay, we can't do anything if we don't agree to that part.
Exactly. You're being honest about the compromise.
Yeah.
You know, and the opponents can at the very least can say, well, we understand that you disagree with us, instead of pretending to kind of endorse their position to bring them into the fold, and it makes you gross.
Yeah,
endorsing a vile set of beliefs in order to get advantage is way less preferable than the negotiation that Trump would do, in my opinion. Just dishonest as well.
If someone is not your friend, you're not forced to
pretend like you're their friend.
Yeah, exactly. You're not forced to pretend.
Yeah. You know, he becomes very, very, you know, Machiavellian, but that's at least honest.
Right. And so she had this tweet that she also put out. The challenges we face: a global pandemic, the global economy, the global climate crisis, mass migration, extreme poverty, social justice, are unrelenting and interconnected, but they're not unsolvable if America is leading the way.
So
that's kind of the package deal, right? Yeah. That you see quite often.
Yeah, this is the sort of left wing. I don't. it is the kind of command state, mm-hmm. isn't it? You know, where it's like we're going to deal with the global pandemic, the global economy, the global climate crisis, mass migration, which is also a global issue, extreme poverty, a global issue, and social justice, whatever that is supposed to mean. So you're right, it is a package. It's mm-hmm. a complete package. And it is the globalist worldview that she's presenting.
Yeah, it's kind of the package that you would also find, the sentiment that you would also find in The Great Reset, for example.
Exactly.
That's why I included this, because this was the connection between her, and she's going to be the U.S. ambassador if Biden gets in. So
she'll doubtless be at Davos.
Yeah, so that's the, she's going to be in agreement with that. But, you know, she's also... She's supposed to be a UN ambassador, so there's an argument to be made that you want people like that to be there so that they can actually pretend to be their friends and do the things that you want. But I don't think she's that type of
person. She's not going to give a Trumpian speech at Davos, that's
for
sure.
But Trump's approach to the UN was to scale back the US's involvement in the UN and to remove as many people as he possibly could, to just leave a skeleton crew behind, to just be there in the positions that are mandated and they are kind of prescribed, but not have any kind of interactions beyond that. And that's one of the approaches, and this is the other one, I guess.
Yeah. It's the complete opposite one. Yeah.
Right. So this is probably the end of the list. Mm-hmm. There's other people there, but I don't think they're too important.
Yeah.
You can just Google them if you're interested in that specific person, but I don't necessarily think that's mm-hmm. it's worth it that much. But I wanted to highlight in the end, at the end, this blue check mark that is commenting on the cabinet picks. And so first, if we go down first, and she's in her Twitter bio, she's an activist, feminist, author, The Weekly List website, podcast, The Weekly List, book, Politico, president of the New Agenda, former Wall Street executive, she, her. And so you can tell by that.
You can see exactly the kind of person.
She's got 500,000 subscribers that,
followers. Yeah,
good for her.
Yeah.
And so this is what she says about the picks. Biden's cabinet so far, 6 women, 6 men. 7 of 12 are people of color. 7 are historical first. And then a lot of hearts, colorful hearts.
Yeah.
Oh, and also an update on Biden's cabinet. 0 family members, 0 wives of congressional leaders, 0 DNC mega donors. All have impeccable resumes and are extremely qualified.
0 family members. As in 0 of his own family members.
Yeah, yeah. Like, unlike Trump, who has like...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like, as if we don't think that there's kind of...
A broad family.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a broad family. Yeah, like all these interlaced... Like the woman saying, oh, Hillary Clinton was the first to call me after the birth of my child. Come on.
You don't do that to your boss.
Yeah, exactly. Come on.
I only said congrats when you came here.
Yeah, like this, that, yeah, 0 DNC mega donors. Yeah, I'm sure that they don't need to have the direct mega donor in the office.
Yeah, and so she's picked some characteristics that are, let's say, true,
yeah,
but she's left out a lot of them, like, okay, all of them are war hawks.
Yeah.
All of them support discredited economic theories and things like that, right? And
so you
have all these things that you could produce exactly the same thing, but with the opposite message, just by listing all their bad qualities.
Which is incidentally what we've done.
Yep.
but unlike her, we've represented the other side of the argument.
Yeah, somewhat.
Somewhat. She's represented it. But anyway.
So this is the blue checkmark view.
Yes, yes. I can see how the narrative they're trying to spin. Imagine trying to spin this cabinet and this president as the president-elect as an anti-corruption, anti-nepotism president.
It's the rainbow bombs.
That's amazing, isn't it? No mega donors. The implication being, well, they're not financed by big money. Oh, come on. No nepotism or cronyism. Come on.
I guess
all of impeccable resumes, yes, in favor of war. Rainbow bombs, they're extremely qualified in fact, right? This reminds me of something that in the Peloponnesian War, right? I love referring to this because all of this harks back. But the Athenians basically used to say similar things like this to the Spartans. They're like, we know this, we know that, we've done this, we've done that. And you Spartans are ignorant and you've learned nothing. And the Spartans just turned around and said, yes, we've learned none of your evil ways. It's like, okay, well, I mean, they're right.
Did they kill all the war prisoners like Stalin?
Who? The Spartans? No, the Spartans.
They didn't learn any of their bad ways because they killed all the war prisoners. They were Stalin did. It's going to be in the dictator's book club.
It is. But no, the Spartans weren't really like Stalin. They were actually kind of... They had a sense of honor, and like they didn't like chasing down defeated foes because they felt it was ignoble. Yeah. But I mean, you know.
I was just trying to make a plug.
But no, but that's a good point. Since we're at the end now, go to loadseas.com and check out our book club. We will have Frank Decotta's Dictators reviewed on there. Myself and Hugo did it the other day, and it was very, very fun to do. It was a very good book.
And as follow well. Amy Siskin on Twitter.
for more neutral and objectively true takes.
Insightful takes.
Thanks, everyone, for watching, and we'll see you later.